Hope you're having a great Saturday morning. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I am Rob Hall, along with Beth Kuchenberger. Good morning, Beth. How are you?
Good morning. Happy Saturday.
Happy Saturday. I'm tempted to ask you how Monterey is, but I already know the answer. It's hot. It's sunny, right? How's Monterey?
It's just, it is, you know, it's the season of flip-flops and ponytails, and it's, swimming pools and as much climate control as you can possibly muster.
I have been there. It's much more than that. It's dripping sweat. It's high humidity. It's the beauty of the mountains all combined into one giant experience. Yeah. And you've got, you got a couple hundred people there right now, right?
We do. We have saying welcome to all of our guests. They arrive on Saturdays, and there are, like 150 people that are here arriving today, and it kind of feels like camp a little bit. They're all coming to spend their week with the orphans, and so today's the day they arrive and get all settled in, and then we kind of get them all excited about what's to come.
Absolutely. We've got a great show today. Two authors with us, but two very different topics. Brooke Obie is going to be with us. She has written about and talks about when the quarter-life crisis won't end. This is kind of a new thing. I hadn't heard a lot about it, but the quarter-life crisis, obviously I'm now 48, so the midlife crisis thing, you know, I hear about and all that kind of stuff. But a quarter-life crisis, kind of that mid-20s, getting your feet on the ground crisis, who am I going to be, what do I want to pursue? And so she'll be on the right after the first commercial break. And then at the bottom of the hour, after the bottom hour of the break, Diane Elliott, who's written a book called The Global Orphan Crisis, will be talking to us about that as well. So an interesting show today.
It's kind of like ladies' hour here today. You're among some powerful women. How are you going to handle yourself among all three of us today?
Well, you know, growing up, talk about a quarter-life crisis, you know, being a therapist, working in education, those are female-dominated professions most of the time, and so this is nothing. This is just like normal.
You know exactly how the quote-unquote
handles exactly
all today,
how it works.
Huh?
You don't really start a conversation. You only really respond when the powerful women ask you a question. That's pretty much how I survived.
Okay, speaking of questions, are you getting your son ready for college?
Yeah, we are, actually. My son is off to the University of Kentucky next year. Yes, TC is screaming through the window there. TC is running the board over there, and he's like, hey, yes, okay, awesome. So we had a great orientation a couple days, and he's all excited, and we're ready to go. You know, he's ready to take off, and we're ready to let him.
Oh, I love that. Well, you know, I live here in Mexico, listeners. And in Mexico, they have this really big deal called ninth grade graduation. It is,
Facebook. I mean, holy cow. It was huge.
It was nicer than any wedding I've literally ever attended. It was, they gave you an attire, like exactly to the sock color, what everybody was supposed to wear. And
really?
The adults look like, they look like they were going to their own version of the prom. And they're adult, and it was quite the shindig. It was a dance. It was like a dinner dance. So these little ninth graders were having dancing, and so were their parents, and we were all dancing together. It was the most interesting event ever.
I tell you, I love hearing stories, just sort of the cultural differences between what happens in Mexico and what happens in the States. So ninth grade graduation. Now, there's got to be a reason that ninth grade graduation is such a huge deal, so enlighten me.
It is. It's the time period where the government stops offering mandatory education. So there are many, 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 many Mexicans who have only achieved their ninth grade degree. Only a fraction of them go on to what we would consider high school, and then even a smaller fraction, about 4 to 8%, go on to college. And so ninth grade graduation has always been a time of celebration. It would be the equivalent of our high school graduation in many ways.
Huh.
And we went there with our long ball gowns and our, you know, fancy ties, and we ate all kinds of
So do they do the whole, like,
first time.
Do they do the whole walk across the stage, call people's names kind of thing? Is it that kind of deal?
Yeah, it is. And there was a dance where the sons had to dance with their mothers and the daughters with their fathers, and of course we have a boy and a girl in that grade.
So it's sort of like a combination graduation wedding reception.
Very much. That's a perfect hybrid. So anyway, it was just once again when I found myself in a cultural experience, like I'm a long way from Americana, but here I am enjoying where it is that God has planted us as a family.
Well, I mean, you've been there. How long have you lived in Monterey? 16 years or something?
Yeah, 17. Yeah.
17 years. So, I mean, when you talk about, hey, you know, I'm still getting used to the culture. You've lived there longer as an adult than you lived in the States as an adult.
Well, you know, it makes me think about, remember when we interviewed the expert on cross-cultural friendships, and we talked a little bit about just how important it is to continue to reach out. I mean, I was the only probably foreigner in the whole room that the other night, but at most rooms you walk in the United States, there's a hybrid of all kinds of nationalities who've come to our little melting pot. And it's easy, super easy to stay with people that sound like you, look like you, smell like you, maybe dance and dress like you. But I remember everything about the people that initiated with us conversation and were gracious. And I just encourage you listeners to be looking for the foreigners in your community and in your social events, and just make a point to reach out to them, because you never know. You just never know. I just met this really interesting person speaking of all that. His name is Doug Shaw, and he is the president of some enormous international student ministry out of Colorado Springs. And he told me that they lead about 8,000 to 10,000 international students to the Lord a year. And that, he said, you should see my Rolodex. I mean, that's kind of an antiquated term, but he said, you know, we've led like the Supreme Justice to China to the Lord when he was a high college student, and we've led. And I think we've just got to keep reaching out to folks, because it's a way you can go into the nations and not get on an airplane.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to ask you a question, seeing how we have the quarter life crisis discussion that's going to come up in our next segment. I want to know, when you were in your 20s, I know that's a long, long time ago for you,
Yes.
Your quarter life, did you have a quarter life crisis when you were like 25 or 23 or something? Were you like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? What was it like?
I was having a quarter life crisis. I don't know if I would have called it a crisis at the time, but I had had 2 years of gainful employment under my belt at that point. You know, I did all the, went to college, got out, got a degree. And I knew, you know, Todd and I had these little matching SUVs, and I had this really cute condo, and I was on a certain trajectory that didn't taste good. Like, that's the way I always describe it. It just didn't taste right. Like, it felt, I had like this little burn.
So it sounds like a crisis to me. You were kind of pursuing the sort of suburban, you know, got matching SUVs, got a little career going, but you had a crisis in the fact that you didn't like it.
We sure did not, and we decided, I remember everything about one night when we decided we wanted an unconventional life, and that we wanted to do and go wherever it is that God would ask us to, regardless of the cost. And it was just shy of my quarter life mark, but that obviously changed the trajectory of my whole life, and I've lived internationally ever since.
Well, there you go.
What about you, honey? What did you do?
Oh my gosh, my life has been one quarter life crisis after another. I think I'm still. It just morphed into a midlife crisis. It went from.
I was going to say they changed names over the years, but.
That's right. It's just one long crisis. I think at 23 or 24, I was finally deciding that I probably wanted to finish college after about 6 years of trying. So my quarter life crisis was, okay, maybe I think I want to know what I might do the rest of my life, kind of thing. Well, of course, that didn't last very long. But so I think when I was 25, I was about to get married when I was 25. That was a great thing. It was
the other
things surrounding what I was going to do that were a little bit difficult. So my crisis I just lived from one to another. You know.
That educational crisis culminated in a PhD. So let's not give the crisis too much credit.
I think I was just pursuing another crisis. You know, I mean, I guess I got to get another degree and another one or whatever. But you know what? Brooke Obie is going to help us unpack this whole thing here right after the break. She's written about when the quarter life crisis won't end. She is a sharp woman. And she's going to talk about the four ways you can take this quarter life crisis and steer it towards a purposeful life. So I am interested to hear what she has to say, and she'll be great. So make sure you join us right after the break. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob, and we'll be back in just a minute.
This past summer, I went on a back-to-back mission trip to India, where I met a little girl named Shailaja from an orphanage with back-to-back. She was a new child at the home and was having a hard time adjusting. As I began playing with her and painting her nails, I was reminded that this little girl was just like my sisters back at home in the United States. Instead of a face on a photo, she became a part of my family when I realized that I could continue to help her through Back2Back's child sponsorship program. Even though she lives over 8,000 miles away, through the Back2Back sponsorship program, I can ensure that her spiritual, physical, educational, emotional, and social needs are met. The best part about the program is when I come home from school and find a letter from Shailaja. I am so thankful for God working within both of our hearts in order to lead us closer to each other and closer to Him. Visit www.backtoback.org for more information.
Welcome back. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I'm Rob Hall along with Beth Kuchenberger. Beth, how are you this morning?
I'm doing very good on this Saturday. I just got back from Colorado. I bet we have some listeners listening to us from Colorado.
It's just like a whole nother world,
the difference between Colorado and Mexico. I'm just telling you. The air, first of all, you walk up a flight of stairs and you're out of breath because of the elevation. It's just a whole other little planet there in Colorado, but it's beautiful.
Hey, I want to let everybody know that we're having some technical difficulty getting a hold of Brooke. Hopefully we'll get that fixed here soon. But until then, you know, we're going to hear about Colorado. I know that you were there for a particular reason. Are you allowed to tell us what that reason was?
Yeah, I just joined as a trustee of David C. Cook Publishing, and it was a privilege to be there. One of the things I like about David C. Cook's mission is that they use their proceeds, their profits from the different products that they produce, curriculum. They own Integrity Music, of course. All their authors like Francis Chan, those guys, they use those to benefit the global church, the underdeveloped and developing world. And they produce materials that they go out and train folks in those worlds about. It's an untold story. I'm going to figure out a way to tell their story better, but it is an untold story.
You got an opportunity right now. How did you get hooked up with David C. Cook? What do they do, by the way? I know that they do books. Do they do other stuff?
They do books. They do curriculum. They do music. You know, they have a pretty large market share of worship music. And, you know, the way I got hooked up with them is because we benefit from one of the products that they produce for the underdeveloped world here in Mexico. And in India, we use something called their Children at Risk or J127 curriculum. And that is this really neat idea. I know you and I have talked a ton about mentors and the value of having somebody speak into your life just because they care about you. We interviewed the author of Wisdom Walks and several folks who talk about the value of mentoring. And these guys, what they do is they try to connect the local church with at-risk children and create a structured bridge with which anybody can walk across and have the tools in their hand to communicate and articulate truths to people who maybe have had a wildly different life experience. And I don't know, do you think that people use or do mentors in the United States culture these days? I mean, I feel like have you ever heard of a church that has an organized mentor program?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think whether it's a formal one or informal, I mean, it needs to be an important part of what's going on. I mean, we're going to hopefully talk about the quarter life crisis, and you and I can talk about it a little bit. I mean, if you're looking at someone 18 years old, 25 years old, there are transitions in life. 35 years old, 55 years, to find someone who has been down that road before you to mentor you, I mean, that makes all the difference in the world. I would find it hard to believe that there is a person out there who couldn't find 1 hour or 90 minutes every week or two to set aside to pour into the life of another person. I mean, it's just such an important thing to do on both ends for the mentor and the mentee that there really isn't any reason why the church shouldn't sort of be active in doing that.
We had the author of the book Castaway Kid, an author named Rob Mitchell, come out here to Mexico. He wrote that book with Focus on the Family. Has since sold hundreds of thousands of copies of that book. And it's a story of his life growing up in an orphanage in the United States in the 50s and 60s. And he talks about how this one guy named John began to become one of his mentors. And he said, you know, in the beginning, he would try to come on Saturday, and people who, and the other kids at the orphanage would be like, hey, that guy, that do-gooder is coming to make himself feel better. He said, I would just, like, dread. And he said, you know, like, a quarter later, after he'd come, been coming for a while, you know, 3 to 6 months into it, I was like, hey, I think John's coming again this Saturday. And I wasn't sure I could act like it was cool, but I was looking forward to it. And he's like, you know, the 9 month mark, I was like, hey, my friend John's coming this weekend. And he said, and here I am, you know, 30 years later, and I can tell you most of the details of those conversations. It was that important to him.
And that consistency over time of him going, of him coming. You know, as I look at what Brooke was going to talk about today, and I think about that, there were four points that she would talk about in this quarter life crisis with people. Reexamine your life. You know, if you're 20 something, reexamine your life. Dump goals and pursue your passions. Reposition yourself. Like, once you've reexamined your life and decided to pursue passions instead of what other people think, you know, you may find that you're not properly positioned to live that life, so you need to change that, your circle of friends, all that kind of stuff, and then repeat that whole process. Without a mentor to help somebody do those four things, reexamine your life, dump your goals and pursue passions, reposition yourself, and then repeat that cycle, you know, people need an outside voice to be able to make that happen for real. You know what I'm saying? I mean, how do you do that without someone to talk to?
Yeah, and I was thinking about how that whole idea of life satisfaction, I mean, Todd and I are always talking about, as we're interviewing and hiring people in within our organization of Back to Back, how the kinds of questions that the interviewee was asking 10 or 15 years ago is totally different than the kind of questions that young adults are asking today. About today's questions are all about satisfaction. They don't really care what the salary schedule is. They don't really care about some of the details that maybe they did a whole generation ago.
They certainly care a lot less than they used to about those kind of things that you and I, when we were looking for work or we were looking to start our career, you know, those were the things that really matter. And it sounds like I just got a word in my ear that Brooke, we finally figured out the technical difficulty, and Brooke is with us. So,
hi.
Brooke, how are you doing? We were just talking about the four ways to take this moment of a quarter life crisis and steer it towards purposeful living. So, yes. I'm glad you're here. Let me give people a brief introduction of who you are and where they can find you. Brooke is a journalist, producer. She's on Ebony.com, a contributing editor who writes the column The Spiritual Life. She's got an award-winning black weblog, award-winning blog, DistrictDiva.com. And I just love these four ways to consider or to conquer your quarter-life crisis. We've been talking about them just between Beth and I. So welcome to the show. Glad you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. We were just talking a little bit, and hopefully you can make these a little bit deeper than we were talking about. The purpose of these four ways that you can take this moment, this quarter-life crisis, and let it steer you towards purposeful living. Talk a little bit about how you came up with sort of these four ways, and let us in on them.
Okay, sure. So basically what happened is that I was actually having a quarter-life crisis. I was 23, I think, I was a little bit early for my quarter-life crisis. And then what happened was, you know, after I kind of felt like I got myself together and things were going well, things started to not go as well as I'd planned again. And it just seemed like it just kept happening. A couple of years would go by. Now, you know, I'm 27, and now I've had a couple of quarter-life crises. And so I was like, you know, this is just not – and I started talking to my friends and figured out, you know, they were having the same kinds of issues. And so what I really learned from that, and just speaking with my pastor and just, you know, reading scriptures on this as well, I just, you know, really discovered that this is something that happens to everybody, and it really comes from just allowing other people to put their goals on us, instead of really just focusing on, okay, why did God put me on earth? You know, what does he want me to do with my life? What passions has he given me that I should be pursuing? And so that's really where it started. And so the first thing I decided to do was reexamine my life, not in a negative way, as in like, well, where did I think that I was going to be at 25 or 27? But, you know, what is it that I should be doing? You know, where should my energies be going? And from there, you know, I could see some of the areas where I really was slacking. You know, I really wasn't putting in as much effort as I could have been putting in. And so, you know, that was kind of a positive thing to kind of just, you know, look at my life realistically and say, okay, I could be doing more, and just getting on the path to doing more. So the second step came about to, you know, kind of reposition yourself to or decide what your passions are instead of your goals. Because when you decide that, you know, you're going to pursue goals, then it's like kind of a checklist. You know, it's like, okay, well, you know, what should I be doing at this age? You know, what would people think that I should be doing? You just sit down and you say, what do I really, really want to do? What does God want me to do with my life? And then you reposition yourself to kind of be able to pursue those things. And so I know, you know, with the economy being so bad, and, you know, people could have children and families that they have to take care of too. And so it could be a lot of, you know, it could be difficult to kind of just pursue your passions wholeheartedly. Some people are just not financially able to do that. So it's like, where can I cut back? Where can I find more time? How can I get back in school if I need to get back in school? Can I do it part-time? You know, can I go at night? I'm a full-time student, and I go at night, and I work it during the day. So, you know, and I repositioned myself from Washington, D.C. to New York so that I could go to the new school and pursue creative writing, as well as, you know, working at the same time. And so, so that's, you just have to kind of figure out, how can I financially do this? How can I do this and not, you know, go broke or go hungry? You know, it could take a lot of time, but, you know, it's kind of just reposition yourself to get to the point where you're pursuing your passions full time. And then to remember that it's going to keep, you know, it's going to keep happening. As long as we're putting, you know, pressures on ourselves to do things that, you know, we think society thinks that we should be doing, whether it's, you know, if you're a woman, you should be married and having children right now, or, you know, I'm getting too old, you know, what if I never get to have children? And then you're just kind of frazzled, and you're adding that kind of stress to your life. Just kind of release all of that stuff and understand that you're exactly where you're supposed to be. No matter if it's in a good position, or, you know, things aren't going as well as you wanted them to go, just know and have confidence that you are exactly where God wants you to be, and just kind of trusting him, you know, just trusting that he's going to help you to do all the things that he puts on earth to do. And so it's kind of just going through these four steps and reviewing them and repeating them, whatever you kind of feel like there's too much pressure on your life, just allowing yourself to remember that it happens to everybody. It's not just you, and that God has everything under control, and just learning to kind of trust that and trust who you are and trust who God created you to be, and that he's going to make a way for those. If he created you to do something, he's going to equip you with the tools. He's going to surround you with the people who are going to help you do that, and that everything is going to be okay. So this is just my kind of woosah post for myself. Yeah, and it just, it's definitely helped me, and definitely helped my readers as well. So.
Yeah. Hey, Brooke, I know we got a late start. Are you able to join us just for a minute or two after the break?
Sure.
Oh, that would be great. I'd be most interested in, when we get back from the break, of hearing, for you, what was the, of these three or four things, what was most difficult for you? So I'm looking forward to hearing that answer when we get back. And Brooke Obie is joining us. She's written about When the Quarter Life Crisis Won't End. And this is Real Life with Beth and Rob. We hope that you'll be back to hear us right after the break.
Do you you have a family member who's getting older and can no longer be safely left alone? Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care, assists senior citizens and adults to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Visiting Angels has over 400 franchised locations across the nation. Experienced, compassionate caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meal preparation, and light housework up to 24 hours a day. Rates are affordable, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. Visiting Angels has cared for hundreds of thousands of seniors nationwide. Franchises are available. Call Visiting Angels toll-free today at 877-374-LIVE. To find an office near you, visit www.visitingangels.com. For home care for your loved ones, call Visiting Angels now at 877-374-LIVE. That's Visiting Angels, America's choice in home care, at 877-374-LIVE.
He found shelter under the rock and lay there looking at the stars. God, do you remember me? In Tales of the Not Forgotten by Beth Guckenberger, Joel dares to ask for what he can't have. Serafina sacrifices what she can't afford to give. Abram looks for an answer buried out of reach, and Christina, saved by a mission, searches for her own. Follow these life-changing stories as they take you on a journey to faraway lands and unfamiliar faces. Travel through their challenges and see the hand of the great story weaver writing endings you'd never imagine. These are the tales of the ones the world doesn't see, tales of the not forgotten. In Tales of the Not Forgotten, learn how God is the great story weaver, weaving the threads of our lives into a strong and beautiful sign of His love. Check out Tales of the Not Forgotten book and missions materials by Beth Guckenberger. For more information or to purchase, go to your local Christian supplier or visit standardpub.com. See lives transformed.
If becoming or staying debt-free is important to you, you're not alone. 10 years ago, I was worried sick, overwhelmed with debt, and so tired of not having enough at the end of the month to make ends meet. I was working a full-time job, but getting deeper in debt every month, and I hated being away from my children. I finally said, that's enough, and I made a decision to do whatever it took to get free from the terrible debt that was causing me so much stress. I'm Gina Neef, and I want to invite you to find the same financial freedom that I found. Not only did I pay my way out of debt, I was also able to leave my corporate job and work from home and be completely available to my family. For years now, I've worked part-time hours, making more than a full-time job would ever pay. I remember the pain of being in over my head, and I'll never forget the joy of becoming debt-free. That's why I show others how to do the same. If you're ready to work from home and find financial freedom, then I'm eager to show you how. Go to findingfreedomnow.com. Discover how you can get free from debt. Go to findingfreedomnow.com.
Last October, I went on a back-to-back mission trip to Nigeria, where I had a chance to meet the boy I sponsored through back-to-back. The moment I met him, it became real that Jeremiah was not just a boy in a picture. He was a boy with dreams, hopes, and a story just like my own kids. At that moment, I saw how back-to-back is changing the lives of orphans around the world. I realized that in the same way I'm here for my children to be part of their stories, I can also be part of Jeremiah's. In the same way that my children can be a brother or sister to each other, they can care for Jeremiah. They can write him letters and share their stories as they grow up. We can help him to receive an education and food to fill his stomach, but more importantly, we can be involved in his life and encourage him to follow his dreams. I learned that sponsoring a child through back-to-back is not just about financial support for an orphan. It is about allowing God to intertwine your story and your heart with a child in need. For more information on sponsoring an orphan like Jeremiah through back-to-back, contact 513-754-0300 or email at childsponsorship@back2back.org.
Welcome back. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I am glad to have you here on this Saturday morning. Good morning, Beth. How are you doing?
I am doing good. Happy Saturday morning, Mr. Hall.
Happy Saturday morning to you down there in Monterrey, Mexico. Hey, before the break, we were talking with Brooke Obie, who's written a blog post, an article, When the Quarter Life Crisis Won't End. And as I mentioned, Brooke is
where was she? When we were 25 years ago,
holy cow. I mean, but I'm glad to know these things now, right? I have some kids that are soon going to be entering this stage of life. So the advice is good no matter what.
Well, Brooke, I was
welcome back, Brooke.
Thank you for having me. So glad to be here with you guys.
Absolutely.
Hey, Brooke, I was I was listening to you talk about those steps, you know, that we re-examine our life and that we pursue passion and not someone else's goals. We reposition ourselves. Those steps that are really helpful to us no matter what stage our crisis is coming. And I was wondering, in your writing and in your discussions with people, what of those are the most difficult? Which one of those kind of trips us up? Are we, you know, usually satisfied with how things are? Do we have a hard time leaving our goals behind? Do we not want to do the pain of repositioning ourselves? Where do you find that people kind of usually trip up in there?
I think it can be the most difficult to actually do step number three, which is to reposition yourself, because you can, you know, it's particularly for people who are like me, who really, really love to overanalyze everything. I mean, you can analyze yourself to death and never do anything, you know, never come to any conclusions about how to get something done. So, you know, it's, yes, it is very, very difficult to let go of, you know, society's goals for you or your parents' goals for you or, you know, the opinions of other people. That's definitely been an idol that I struggle with, that my friends are struggling with, and my readers are struggling with as well. Just like not, you know, bowing down to the goals that other people put on your life. But what's most difficult, what's been for me the most difficult, is to actually, you know, be able to get up from Washington, D.C. and say, you know, this is not what God wants me to do with my life. I am a writer. I'm supposed to be a writer. You know, even I have a Juris Doctor degree. And so everybody's like, well, why aren't you practicing law? You know, why are you going to go back to school? Why are you moving to New York? You're so far away from your family and, you know, all of that. And you know, having parents worrying about whether or not, you know, I'm going to go to the poorhouse or have to move back in with them. You know, it's, you know, nobody wants that. You know, you want your kids to be, you know, successful and doing the best that they can be doing. So, yes, it was very difficult to actually say, you know what, I'm going to school, I'm back to school, I'm going to get another degree, I'm going to focus on what it is that God really gave me a passion right. for. So, yeah, so definitely repositioning yourself. Because the other part of that as well is to get away from kind of negative influences. Right. And you could have, you know, friends that you've had your whole life, and then to have to kind of steer yourself away from those people can be very, very hard to let those people go. And it can also, you know, kind of cause controversy, because people become uncomfortable around you when you start living in your passion and your purpose. It kind of rubs them the wrong way. If they're not also living their passion and their purpose, it's kind of, it can cause a bit of a conflict. But for me, that's just been an awesome opportunity to witness to them, you know, and they're like, well, what's right. going on with you? Where are you going? Why are you doing something different? Like, well, you know, this is what God has called me to do, and this is what I really want to do, without actually kind of preaching to your friends about, well, you should be doing the same thing. You know, they're going right. to, when they see you walking in your purpose and they see how God is blessing you and your life, they're like, well, you know, I want in on that. You know, God, what do you want me to do with my life? Let me walk in my purpose. Let me walk in my passion. And, you know, you're just kind of changing the world like one step at a time.
Just by
being obedient.
Yeah. So, Brooke, I know that people are going to want to find the article, and as well as after hearing you, many of the other things that you've written. Where can they find your work?
So every Tuesday I do the Spiritual Life column on ebony.com, and then all of my work, I freelance a couple of other places as well, and then my blog, all of that information can be found at brookobie.com.
And that's O-B-I-E, Brooke Obie, yes. BrookeObie.com, correct?
Yes. Yes, it is. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for coming on, and best of luck to you. Blessings to you.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed having this conversation with you guys.
All right. Thanks, Brooke. Beth, I can't, you know, that last comment I think that she said in passing, just, you know, being surrounded by people who may question whether or not you're doing the right thing, that is a difficult thing to overcome, all those voices in your head and all those voices in your ear telling you, hey, why aren't you doing this thing instead of that? Why are you pursuing that? That's a hard thing to overcome.
It certainly is, and it takes, I mean, it really will crystallize your calling or your passion if you're willing to go and silence those voices and in hear instead the voice inside of your heart and mind. That is and should be that the X factor, the impetus to make the changes that are needed.
Absolutely. And we're going to shift gears quickly, but that comment about finding your call, about being obedient to it, our next guest, Diane Elliott, has written a book, The Global Orphan Crisis, about God's call to care for the orphan and vulnerable children. This is one of, as anybody who's listened to us for more than a half hour knows, that orphan care is near and dear to our hearts. So to have someone on like Diane to talk about God's call to care for the orphan and vulnerable children, this is what we love to talk about. So, Diane, we are so glad to have you on the show. We're excited to talk about your new book and to talk about a subject that the three of us have a great passion for. So, good morning.
Good morning. I am so excited to be here, too. And it's great to meet you, Rob and Beth. It was wonderful to meet you at the last conference we were at, and we did not get a chance to sit and chat, so I'm so excited that we have this opportunity to do that today.
Yeah, absolutely. Diane, would you start by just telling our readers a little bit about what the research that you undertook in the last couple of years, what it led to, how it culminated in this book, and some of the things that you learned?
Yeah, that's a big question. I'm going to give you the short answer because that could go on for a while, but the short answer is I think sometimes when we least expect it, God calls us to something that we didn't expect, and he doesn't always call the equipped, but he equips the called. And so I feel like he gave me the opportunity to write this book. I had had a little bit of experience in orphan care in the past, but not nearly as much as some of my friends that I have met along the path. But what was culminated in it was the opportunity to really dive into the orphan crisis and try to look at it in the big picture and see what it looks like around the world, not just in the United States, not just in Africa, but really to take a global perspective. And I think in the 2 years or year and a half that I was immersed in that, God revealed some amazing things to me, both changing my heart as well as bringing up some information that was really helpful in kind of assessing the big picture of the orphan crisis and then drilling it down, because I think if we just stay in that place where we look at the bigness of the problem, we are pretty much mobilized. But drilling it down to the point of saying, okay, we can make a difference. We can see possibilities for the future that each of us can be involved in that can make a difference in the life of a child in the middle of Africa or the middle of Mexico or in India. So trying to drill the information down to make it really practical and really applicable to everyone today.
When you were, I mean, I know a little bit about your story and some of the experiences you'd had internationally before you started writing, but was there anything in your research that surprised you or that our listeners maybe wouldn't know about the movement that's happening right now?
Yeah, I think the biggest surprise for me actually came about halfway through the writing of the book when I found out that, you know, adoption is a wonderful answer to the orphan crisis. And in the United States, especially in the Christian community, there has been an upsurge of interest in adoption, which is phenomenal. But what surprised me so much about the big picture of adoption is that adoption only serves, at the most, about 250 children a year. And that's internationally, that's half of that is usually children coming into the United States or inter-country adoption in the United States. But what surprised me so much is if there is, at the top, 250,000 children that are adopted a year, that means that's only 1% or less than 1% of what the real crisis is. So let's look at the big picture for just 1 minute, and then we'll drill it down.
We got about 1 minute, Diane.
Okay. What was that?
We've got about 1 minute till break, and so we'll certainly pick it up when we're done. So go ahead and keep talking.
Great. We have 153 million orphan children around the world today. If we look at the United States, there's about 309 million people in the United States. So if we were to cut the United States in half, population-wise, that would represent half of the people in the United States represents one orphan child each. So, I mean, that's a phenomenal amount of people that are orphaned children around the world. So that's a huge number, but again, when we really drill it down, adoption is only taking care of less than 1%. So the 99%, we have to do something different.
Yeah. We're talking with Diane Elliott, the author of The Global Orphan Crisis, and I'm looking forward to when we get back talking a little bit about what we can do individually to help with the global orphan crisis, and we'll do that right after this break.
Who's Weaving Your Story? The Story Weaver series by Beth Guckenberger highlights the plight of orphans throughout the world in personal, heart-grabbing stories of loss, struggle, and redemption, the kind of redemption only God, the great story weaver, can accomplish. Written for ages 8 and up, Tales of the Not Forgotten and Tales of the Defended Ones reveal God's ability to create a story far greater than we can imagine. And the corresponding 6-part Leader's Guides on CD help turn each book's content into a simple yet powerful 6-week curriculum for any church or small group. Use both together and you have a 12-week curriculum full of fun activities, compelling stories, biblical teaching, and practical applications. Let God weave your story and see what He can accomplish for orphans worldwide. The Story Weaver series is published by Standard Publishing and is available at www.standardpub.com or your favorite Christian bookstore.
Welcome back. This is Real Life with Rob and Beth. You know, like how I changed that on you, Beth? You talked to me earlier. It's really actually Real Life with Beth and Rob. She was just giving me a hard time earlier in the show about her name being first. So, you know, Beth, I had to at least do something about that. Anyway, this is Real
Life
with Beth and Rob.
You are the proverbial big brother.
I am Rob Hall, along with Beth Guckenberger, and we are talking with Diane Elliott, who's written a great book, The Global Orphan Crisis. And, Diane, we are just so glad to have you on the show today. So happy Saturday morning to you.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
Diane, I just wanted you to have a chance to finish up your thought that we had right before the break about the big picture and the small picture, about how we do need to do something because only 1% of the orphan population is being served in adoption, both in our country and international adoption. And so here we are left with these 99% of the 153 or 63, depending on your statistic, million children around the world. And what are some things our listeners can do, really practical ways that they can get involved in the orphan care movement?
Yeah, I think that's really important to drill it down and to come up with some real practical ways so that we can serve orphan kids in you know, many different ways. There are some people that are going to be called to go. Some people are going to have a call in their life, a passion on their life, to go and minister to orphan children directly. But the majority of us are going to be called to support those that do. And what that might look like is finding an organization like Back to Back Ministries, like Oasis for Orphans, like Loving Shepherd Ministries that are doing wonderful work around the world and supporting those ministries that are. And you can support them in many different ways. You can support them just, for example, by looking at who you are and how God has designed you to be. You can find out what your passion is, what you are good at, what He's gifted you in, and try to support a ministry in that way. So, for example, if someone is really administratively gifted or financially gifted, and there's an orphan care ministry that's available to you in locally or even a little bit further away, we have electronics now that we can kind of connect to anybody anywhere. And so if you can serve them administratively or helping with their books financially, that kind of thing, by volunteering. Other things are, I have a friend who loves to make little Afghans. And so she makes Afghans, and they send them around the world to orphan children. And when I was in Haiti, I went to one children's home, and on the bunk of every child was a handmade little Afghan. And can you imagine how a child feels when they get a personalized gift like that that they can sleep with every night? I think that was so special. So it can be small things. It can be enormous things. Of course, donations. Of course, prayer is enormous. And then being really creative. I think there's a lot of business people out there that are real creative in developing businesses. And I spent the better part of one day last week talking with a guy that has started a business in Haiti, and they've employed over 250 artisans. And they are making a significant income for these artisans in Haiti. So they're not only helping orphan children with the proceeds of that, but they're actually keeping moms with their children by giving them jobs and employment so that they can keep their children instead of feeling like they can't afford to keep their children. And that's a huge thing. Prevention is just enormous. So there are so many things that we can do, from large to small, and it's just, we're only limited by our own creativity.
I know it's been a few months since the book has come out. Tell me a little bit about what the reaction or response has been in the global community and the orphan care movement. How have people been receiving what it is that you've produced?
Yeah, a couple different reactions. One is it's for some people, especially people that are not real familiar with orphan care, it's a difficult book to read, especially the first half. And so I had some people report back to me that hearing how difficult it is for orphan kids, seeing the picture of what they go through is really hard to see. And that's true. But I will tell you, and I cried through many of those chapters as I was writing them, honestly, but the reality is we have to be willing to look at tough and difficult things so that we can move to the second or the next phase, which is action. And in the second half of the book is the redeeming part of the book that talks about God's care for orphan children, how he feels about orphan children, and then it gives real practical application of what can be done and how you can do it. So I think that's the first reaction. The second reaction is it's just lit some people's fire, which is so exciting to see. And one gal, her name is Jerrianne Seigen, and she goes to a little church, and it's called Northwest Christian Community in the suburbs of Chicago. And she got so excited about the book when it came out, read the book, and happens to know a friend of mine, and we got connected. So we had a little bit of an hour or two together where we had coffee and just shared about what she was thinking, and she wanted to start an orphan care program at her church. So after reading the book, she had her tools, and then I gave her some other suggestions, and she went back and went crazy, and they have started an orphan care program. They've sponsored a little guy named Angel, and he lives in Guatemala. And then they've also had several speakers come in from Safe Families, and she spoke about her adoption with a child from Guatemala. And I was there yesterday as they just announced that they were sponsoring this little guy. And the commitment level of the church in the congregation is growing, and people are getting involved. And two of the families have decided to become Safe Family sponsors. So it's just very exciting to see what's happening around the country. Another gal is a teacher at a Christian high school, and she is in charge of the summer reading program, and she assigned the book to her students, and she has 500 high school students, and so they're going to be reading that over summer break, and then I'll be coming to the school in the fall and speaking with them about it. And so that was the beginning, and then the ball just started rolling, and so now we're talking about doing some short-term mission projects and a service project and sponsorships and things like that. So it's just exciting to see what God is doing with a small little tool, a little resource that can help people to get started in a good direction.
Well, Diane, I'd love for people to get their hands on it. I assume that the book is available at Christian bookstores, but where can you direct our listeners to find the book?
Yeah, it's a Moody publication book. So you can get it through their website. You can get it through Amazon.com. You can also go to our website, which is globalorphancrisis.com. It's actually Global Orphan Crisis, not with the in front. So globalorphancrisis.com, and find out more about it there.
Just great, exciting stuff. Great stories attached to what sounds like started with you as just a passion of yours, and has exploded into the writing of this book and beginning to influence people all over the United States and beyond. So, Diane, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Beth. Great talking with you guys.
Great talking to you as well. Blessings to you, Diane.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. It's just, you know, this topic, it's amazing the more that we talk to people, you know, we talk about this topic often, that the same themes, it's not like everybody's sitting in a room trying to figure out how to write about the same stuff or think about the same stuff, but everybody has a little twist on, but what seems to be very similar themes. How can individual people get involved, even if they don't have to go on a mission trip? How do I sponsor someone? How do we move from institutionalizing orphans to connecting them with families? That seems to be an ongoing theme.
It is, and you know, Diane reached out to me in the middle of her research before the book came out and asked if I would write the foreword to the book. And my first reaction to her was, you don't have any field experience. You're writing a book about orphan care. Like, I'm not so sure. She said, well, just take a look at what I've put together and see what you think. And when I read the content of the book, I thought, what I would have done for a book like this 15 years ago when I got started. And everything I learned was, it felt like the hard way, and way more anecdotally than the kind of research she very, you know, systematically puts out. And that's really, when I talk about this particular book, I say, I think as a movement, the orphan care movement needs to be more about sharing information, collaboration, connection. We need to stop functioning in small silos. In fact, I have a woman here right now from Guatemala who found us on the website, and she does a ministry kind of like what we do in Monterey, but she does it in Guatemala, just on a smaller scale. And we had a few email exchanges. Listeners, I'd be happy to do this with you. And I just said, why don't you come here and see what we do, and anything that we have, we'll share with you. So I just set her up in the office this morning with every manual, every Bible study, every document we've ever created or generated as an organization, and said, you can download and have anything, put your own logo on it. And I think that that spirit Diane brought to that book, that idea that, like, this is what we kind of all know. Now let's take what we know and continue forward, instead of all of us having to learn kind of at our own pace.
Yeah, and I'd love to remind our listeners that they can go to backtoback.org. You know, Diane talked a lot, and we talk a lot about on the show, about, you know, there are different levels of getting involved in orphan care, from I don't really know a whole lot, but I feel like I should begin to move in that direction, to sponsoring a child, to going on a short-term mission trip, to all, Back-to-Back has all that stuff, backtoback.org, and all over the world, whether it's here in the Western Hemisphere and in Mexico, whether it's Haiti, whether it's Nigeria, whether it's India. So I would direct our listeners there as a great resource to sort of begin to press into this idea of orphan care that Diane so eloquently puts into her book.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll be taking trips all around the world this year, and I invite anyone to join us. Any listener who's thinking to themselves, I want to go on a mission trip, but I'm not really sure what to expect. I'm not really sure who can I trust. You know, certainly do all your due diligence and check us out. But if anybody would like to come on a trip somewhere around the world that I'm leading, all they'd have to do is get in touch with us via our Facebook or website, and we'd be happy to invite you onto a trip to serve and just have that firsthand experience.
Absolutely. Hey, if you're wondering about any of these resources, if you want to share this show, hey, we overcame some technical difficulties today. Not bad.
Yes, we right? did. Yes, we
Jim,
did.
Jim, the producer, helped us figure that out, and we figured it out. Real Life with BethAndRob.com, or you can follow us on Facebook, Real Life with Beth and Rob. We have access to all of our all the people we had on the show and past shows and all of those kind of things. Backtoback.org if you're interested in finding some information about how to get plugged into orphan care. So plenty of resources out there. Next week we got another great show. The director of Poverty Cure, Michael Matheson Miller, will be with us, as well as Bishop W.C. Martin, who has written a book, Small Town, Big Miracle. I think when Bishop Martin's on, we're just going to say, hey, Bishop Martin, how you doing? And it'll be off and running. This guy's got more energy, like, sleeping than I do in my most wide-awake moments.
Yes. The first time I heard him speak, he was electric. He brought energy into the room that no one anticipated. I'm excited about next week.
Some great guests next week as well. Beth, have a great week. It's always a great Saturday hanging out with you, and hopefully our listeners had a great Saturday hanging out with us. This is Real Life with Beth and Rob. I'm Rob Hall, along with Beth Kuchenberger, and we'll be back here next week.